Well, hello, and a very warm welcome back to the Andrew Eborn Show with me, Andrew Eborn. And it's that special time, my favourite time in the legal discourse that we occasionally have in a pair of briefs. And I'm joined yet again by Stephen Barrett. How are you, Stephen?
I always have to try and think of an innovative answer to this. It's like the Simpsons couch gag. And I'm just not that creative. I'm fine. I'm looking at Bella having a gnaw on a bit of deer horn.
Oh, there you go. Bella, we have to say, is the dog. It's not. It's no offspring or anything.
No, and she's a beagle, and beagles do like to chew.
Oh, I had a beagle. I had a beagle called Skipper. They're really good, and I love it. Man's best friend is a dog. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. How did that work out? It's got to be good.
Yeah,
anyway, we're looking every time in a pair of briefs, and I've been loving the feedback. I tell you what, they really appreciate it, this sort of stuff, unpacking it in an easy to understand way where people can ask the questions about the law and so on and so forth. And one of the big questions has always been about transparency. And the recent case, the awful, appalling circumstances which unfolded about Sarah Sharif's murder. And there was, first of all, the three judges involved in the family court hearings. They basically said they couldn't be disclosed the names because it might prejudice them in terms of accessibility, it might put them at risk and so on and so forth. It's now been decided that, no, they should be named. And so they have. And they are Judge Alison Rayside, who sat on most of the hearings, Judge Peter Nathan and Judge Sally Williams. And the background to this, I mean, awful, awful case, which we've heard more and more about, is that Sarah Sharif was murdered by her father, Irfan Sharif, and stepmother, Binash Batul, in Woking, Surrey, in 2023. And they were subsequently jailed for life. What was flagged up is that she came to their attention, Sarah came to their attention several times with the authorities, and the wrong course of action was taken. She wasn't put into care or anything else. She was sent back to her parents, who continued the appalling abuse. And the question then is, to what extent are the judges involved liable? Now, the general principle, and we can dig deeper into this and the rationale behind it, the general principle is that the judges don't have liability, that they have a sort of impunity for the judgments that they make. Talk us through the history of that.
So that is, I think, quite a prudent constitutional mechanism. Barristers, too, used to have immunity from liability, and they took it away from us. And it's led to a lot more anxiety amongst people like me. I'm not sure it's necessarily improved the profession. The one thing that listeners and viewers who might want barristers to be liable in negligence can take some comfort in is that we have a specialist insurance company that insures us, and our premiums are ridiculously low because we hardly ever get sued. So barristers in this country genuinely do hardly ever get sued because, you know, 99.9% of them are don't make mistakes and are terrified of doing it. But the principle that judges should be immune for anything done in their courtroom is a constitutional one to make sure that judges aren't overly scared, don't make bad decisions out of fear or intimidation. And so imagine a very rich person who'd be able to sue the judge viciously can't do that. You know, that we do need to talk about malicious use of the courts, and we have to be grown up about that and think about it. It's not as wide as Her Majesty's or His Majesty's. Oh, it's still painful, Andrew.
I know. I always say that, and it is painful, isn't it? We always think. I mean, it was that instant thing about Queen's Counsel that sort of happened instantly. Everybody became King's Counsel within that nanosecond. No, I always think of to Her Majesty's pleasure, detained in to Her Majesty's pleasure, and so on and so forth, and everything in Her Majesty's name. And whenever you refer to the Queen, I still think of Elizabeth and not Camilla.
Yes, I mean, it's just hard to shift. And I will just always be that man who was born in the last century under the old queen and still gets weepy eyed about her. But we had to issue in the Queen's Bench the next day. So we actually had to issue in the King's Bench.
Yes. No, it's the one thing that didn't require any further action.
Nope.
That's the thing about barristers. All the Queen's Counsel instantly became King's Counsel. And as you say, the Queen's Bench became the King's Bench, and off you go.
Yeah, and I think that's, people should take reassurance and comfort in that, because one of the problems with our infantile age is that people keep pausing and going, oh, do I have permission to do this? It's like our constitution literally does not work that way. The minute The queen died. We had a king. We all knew he was the king. Like dominoes. Loads of things instantly changed. Nobody had to do anything. Nobody had to pass a law. Nobody had to pronounce anything. You know, it was that simple. It was the queen is dead. Long live the king. That's it. And it is instantaneous. He didn't even need to have a coronation. You know, it's just boom.
It's automatic, and in a way it is comforting, as you say. It's on that sort of side, but we digress, as we often
We've
do,
digressed. We've
which is
digressed.
also. So let's get back to this immunity and impunity, rather, that judges enjoy in the exercise of their judgment.
Yes, so there's this thing called His Majesty's Courts and Tribunal Service, which is the bureaucracy, the civil service bureaucracy, which runs, or in theory runs, the courts. Because Tony Blair fell for this nonsense about separation of powers, which is not true, he tried to make it independent, and basically it's just unaccountable is what it's become, not independent. I believe it to be liable in negligence for what it does. So I'll just explain this to listeners and viewers, but it will, in our world, it will regularly do something bad, like say you all turn up to court and it says you haven't got a judge. Right, well, if I'm turning up to court, I cost money. My solicitor costs money. My opponent costs money. My opponent's solicitor costs money. You know, it might be experts, might be witnesses, this might be quite an expensive procedure. I mean, I did a court case where it was just a 2-hour hearing. 2-hour hearing, Andrew, but there were 14 what are now King's Counsel in that hearing. There was
Yes, yeah.
Muggins, and then all the KCs had a junior. I didn't have a junior. But I did have a solicitor. Everybody had solicitors and solicitor juniors. So I was just in an idle moment, I was sort of going around trying to tot up what the total cost of this 2-hour hearing was. But you know, it's in millions of pounds and probably tens of millions of pounds. So these things are desperately expensive. And when HMCTS, Her Majesty, His Majesty's Court and Tribunal Service, just says, "Sorry, we haven't got a judge." They often then pretend that this immunity extends to them, and I don't believe it does. And I've always wanted a test case. My father doesn't believe it does either, because they just don't. Why would they have judicial immunity? It's not in, when they're doing things in the back office and
Yeah,
choosing listing dates, that's
and
not judicial
I
action.
think that's right, actually, because I think it's basically doing with the judicial process. That's where the immunity applies. But if it's administrative, which that was clearly, it was KC without his sunshine band, I guess, but ridiculously expensive. You're right, and if that's negligent, then people should be held to account.
And I've got them to give compensation to a client because it was a sad case, and she was a nice sweet lady, and you know she was going to be out of pocket. So I literally said to her, "Leave this with me and the solicitor. We'll get them to pay." And I also said, "If we can't get them to pay, I won't bill you." You know, so you've got to be decent about it. But we did actually get them to back down and pay. They don't by default pay, and I don't know of anybody else who's ever got them to pay, but they should. And the principle of that is the opposite one, is that accountability can make things much more efficient. I mean, you know, when I am obsessive about my law, is it because I've been liable in negligence for 21 years or 22 years? When I look at a lawyer who I consider sloppy, and obviously I wouldn't name anybody, is it because they're unlikely to get sued? You know, is the risk of being sued doesn't make you better at your job? It hasn't in the NHS, so. I don't know about this theory, but I do like, I'm not anti-accountability all the time. And I think it's generally a question for all of us to think through when we should have accountability and not have accountability, what the trade-offs are. I mean, for judges, it doesn't really matter because I don't think they'd be more accountable if they were personally liable.
Yeah.
They can be appealed, and believe me, to a judge, that is the worst thing that can possibly happen. And I'll just explain that concept for why. Imagine you have spent decades of your life working as probably a barrister, possibly a solicitor. You are a highly status motivated individual because most lawyers are. And you take yourself very seriously because you probably never lied, certainly never professionally lied in you know 30, 40 years of life. You start to see yourself as deeply honourable. You've risen through the heights to be a judge, And somebody you respect more, who's because they'll be a little bit older than you, so you will have known about them for all of your career, and you
Yes.
probably won't be in complete awe of them, and they might appeal you and say you're a moron. And that's really painful. I mean, it's personally painful. I've watched judges get very upset at the idea. There was a former president of the Supreme Court who did a case called Menelaus, which is in arbitration, and the decision is pretty bad. But there was a very, very, very well-respected professor who was from this judge's old university. I'm pretty sure he was from his old college, so that will
Right.
hurt even more. And he gave a lecture to the Chancery Bar Association saying what he honestly thought about it and didn't pull any punches. I mean, if people think I'm rude on Twitter, there is a lot of rudeness in academia. There just always has been, always will be. Look at, I can name so many academics who go for each other, right, completely at the neck. And it became, I mean, most of us were mildly scandalized. I mean, I tend to be easily amused, but it came to be known that that judge had been personally saddened by that criticism.
Yeah, and it's not, as I say, it's not just the humiliation, I guess that's the right word, isn't it, of being appealed. It's also when the general public have a pop at you. They say this judge is senile, they've got not sort of not relating to the people anymore, you've got this sort of stuff, and they get hauled through the coals, don't they?
Well, that one I always support constitutionally. So I get very angry at people, at lawyers who take inconsistent positions because I expect the law to be consistent. And a lot of my fellow lawyers will get terribly snooty about the Daily Mail calling three, in fact, brilliant, three of our brilliant judges, including Terry Etherton, who they made a really rude reference to his sexuality for no good reason. He's a fantastically respectable man. But the Daily Mail called him enemies of the people. And I've always taken the view that the Daily Mail has every right to do that if you want to. But the people who got sanctimonious about it and said, I mean, I don't agree with them, but it's their right, free press, constitutional function, judges are not immune from criticism, public have a right to say what they think. It'll either be a good comment or the Daily Mail won't sell any papers that day. That's the constitutional mechanism for that in a free society. A lot of my fellow barristers got incredibly sanctimonious about that and tried to pretend that some great wrong had been done, some great awfulness, some assault upon the rule of law, or this is utter tosh. And then a few months later, the London Review of Books did exactly the same thing, but it was by a respected left-wing KC, or now KC. And it was far ruder because it used much more technical language. So it was far more intellectual than the Daily Mail. So I would have been so much more irritated by the London Review of Books. But because it was the London Review of Books, because of who did it, that wasn't a scandal. Right. Well, awooga, awooga, klaxon sounds. That's an inconsistent position. And I cannot abide inconsistent positions. Either both are wrong or both are allowed. And actually, the correct constitutional answer, Andrew, is that both are allowed.
And
So I.
I think it is interesting, and this is why they started televising sentencing in the first instance for the court, is to increase understanding. And I had a lunch with the person who was responsible whilst he was at Sky just a few days ago, Simon Bucks, it was his name. He was at Sky at the time. He then did Forces Television. He's now at Ofcom, interestingly. And he was telling me, he sent me a copy of the letter that he sent at that stage, or Sky sent at that stage, saying all about transparency. And they thought, well, look, we'll start with sentencing. And they were very concerned because of the wall-to-wall media coverage of O.J. Simpson. They thought it would bring everything into disrepute. But starting with the judge's sentencing, we've spoken about this beforehand, it does help not just with that sort of transparency, because justice should not just be done, but seem to be done, but also with understanding, doesn't it?
I hope so. I mean, I watched the sentencing of Axel Rudi Cabana, and I mean, that I think was very useful for the nation. It does depend upon the skill and the human skill of the judge. That's another burden on their shoulders. I think publishing the written sentencing remarks, I do desperately approve of. I think that's absolutely right. And I generally like more transparency. I think it is good for them and for us, and we should come closer. There shouldn't be really walls between the judiciary and the public. I don't think that, it's very useful to have walls between the public and any form of power, which is why power should be accountable, even if that hurts, even if that's not terribly respectable at all times, if it's not terribly respectful at all times, even if it crosses the line into rudeness and mockery. That's absolutely fine. It must never then cross another line, which is into violence and threats of violence.
Yeah, well, and that was the point. So whilst they sort of turn around and say, okay, you can publish the sentencing remarks and so on and so forth, and now the family courts, as of last Monday, a week ago, they're now allowing journalists to report from family court matters. They can't mention the families concerned, but they can detail aspects of the case and so on and so forth, with the idea that they can improve the system and transparency on that sort of basis. But going back to your point about risk of harm, if you like, to the judges, Mr. Justice Williams, he made the High Court order originally saying that these three judges concerned in Sara's case basically said there would be a real risk of harm to the judges from a virtual lynch mob. But people like the BBC appealed the decision. They said, look, decision making should be open to public scrutiny. How do you get that balance right?
Well, we need to get a more healthy relationship with fear. So there are a number of things to unpack about Mr. Justice Williams. Firstly, I just noticed this when they published the name of the judges, and it's unfortunate and it's almost certainly completely accidental, and in no way a family link. But he shares a surname with one of the three of them, which I think in an older age, given justice needs to be seen to be done, that would have at least worried you. I think a judge, if I was a judge, I'd go, ah, am I the right judge to do this? I know I'm not related to so and so, but people might accidentally think I am, and this might accidentally cause the judiciary to not be as well respected as it could be. So I'm slightly surprised he missed that one. And then everything else comes from his, I would say, and it's not him, he's not unique in this, but we have an out of control relationship with fear at the moment. So he said that there would be a reasonable fear of a virtual lynch mob. Right. Okay, let's go absolutely back to basics. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. A virtual lynch mob is not a lynch mob. It
No.
isn't. And it's not a risk of violence, is it? It's a risk of hurty words online, which is an entirely different process. And having been the victim of virtual lynch mobs in my time, we do have to man up and have a different relationship with them. And I'm afraid we do have a really unhealthy relationship with fear, because and I'll, the best way I think I'm going to start illustrating this is that there is a tiny chance every time I step outside my front door, that a tiny little asteroid, they strike the planet every now and again in random places, will strike exactly on as I step outside my front door and go through my head and kill me. There is a tiny chance of doing that. And that tiny chance, that risk, is what we mean by reasonable risk and what we mean by, dealing with Bella as being a very naughty dog. Bella
Where is
or Matt.
Bella? Bring Bella up. Let's have a look at Bella. Will she come and make her TV debut on the
Bella,
Andrew Bourne? Bella, come on.
come here.
Very obedient. Here we are. Here's Bella. Let's have a look at Bella. Glorious. Ah, wonderful. How old is Bella?
She's 3 and a half.
They're wonderful beagles, aren't they? I love. How long do they live for? They're not as long as some of the much smaller dogs.
No, I'm working on the basis of 9 or 10. Now,
Yes.
for Matt, please. Bella got Matt. She likes to go to the chair.
No, I understand.
There's a comfy chair in the library, and she likes to go there.
Good.
Not allowed to, but that's what she does.
Yes.
Sorry about that, but
That's all right, though. No, it's much better. I always remember what I love about these Zoom things, and people made the big mistake of forgetting that life doesn't really happen. And some of the most glorious moments, you remember somebody that was a correspondent and their little child came in, I think on a wheeler, and the nurse or the nanny or the or maybe even the mother came in running, tried to hide from the camera, and everybody could see what was going on. It was one of the most highlighted moments in this sort of lockdown and Zoom calls, is that you've got to embrace the moment, don't you?
yes, and that's what I mean, really. That illustrates the point about a healthy relationship with fear.
Yes.
It was the mum who did that. We were all watching, well, most of us were watching the BBC at the time. Most of us quite happy to see a little child be naughty and do things because, it's joyful. What was the risk that was being mitigated? What was the, why are we so worried about this? And so often in life, I seem to infuriate fellow lawyers because they have a much lower appetite to risk than I have. And I don't really understand why they've got such a ridiculously low appetite to risk. But lawyers do seem to be, in particular, highly, highly risk averse. So that the most common allegation they make against me is that I've misled the public. And it's like, okay, even if I haven't, so calm down. And I certainly would never do it deliberately. So again, please be polite. But if I have, what's the worst thing that happens? Somebody for a little while believes something about the law which may or may not be true, and then they'll get corrected. It's, this is this is
But it's
not the
crazy.
end of
But
the
we
world.
do. You raise a very interesting point because we do live in fear, and you find that even in broadcast, people are risk adverse now. They won't say things in case they get sued. They won't necessarily do more adventurous programming in case the audience don't like it. So you get regurgitation of old formats which were successful, and so on and so forth. And comedy, the comedy is now being sort of castrated in a way. You can't say certain things that you can't cause offence in case you get sued on that basis.
No, and it's part of our unhealthy relationship with fear. And we just need to grow up and just realize that some fear is okay. With some you just live with it. I mean, I don't drive probably because I have an unhealthy relationship with fear, but if you drive, you are risking your, cars can kill and accidents do happen. So I think we need to have a better relationship with
Oh,
fear. I think
life is dangerous. I get it. I think you've got to work on that. But it's an interesting point, and I haven't heard somebody say this. Mr. Justice Williams, having the same surname as Judge Sally Williams, it may or may not have been a factor. But Sir Geoffrey Voss, in his wisdom, Master of the Rolls, he found in favour of the media, saying the whole idea of anonymising the judge was, I have to say, misguided.
yes, I think they've got immunity from suit, which, just for listeners and viewers, that's that thing where they can't be sued personally. That is enough. Okay, they don't get anonymity too. And I have to say, I can be quite a scathing critic of the family division. I actually get on with a number of family lawyers because I'm quite a scathing critic of the family division, and they are too. So I got invited to write in a family law academic journal to be rude about a family law judge who had made an idiotic decision, which was unlawful in international law, and it was incorporated international law, Andrew, so it was really just bad. But anonymity has not helped the family division. So I'm glad that, and I don't think anonymity helps judges. It will just put a barrier between them. There's an example I want to raise, which is that the Victorians knew, and I'm very Victorian of mind, and the Romans knew, and Augustus knew. Do you know you can go visit the house of Augustus, the Emperor Augustus? And it's a tiny little house. And it's not surrounded by massive gates and walls and fortresses. And everybody knew where he lived. And that is a big political statement. And what the Victorians could have done, they could have had all this nonsense of, the American style or South Africa style gated communities and, big iron gates and guard towers and to keep them away from the public and all the rest of it. But no, they just lived in London, cheek by jowl. And you all mix up. The other great leveler that the Victorians had, which the Romans would have had, is shared religious experience. So it didn't matter how poor you were or how rich you were probably going to the same church. And certainly in a small village or town, everybody's going to the same one place on a Sunday, and the Lord of the Manor will be there, and Joe the peasant will be there. He just th that that's what happens, and that's a nice mixing, and it leads to a far more stable, healthier, less violent society. Whereas when the rich start hiding away and going into gated communities, that should be a warning flag that actually, bad things might be about to happen when the French court.
So we've got the transparency about who the judges were. We dealt with the fear there's online abuse. I mean, there are other risks, and people in the public eye have been attacked physically. So I do understand that concern. But the facts have also come out now. So Judge Alison Rayside was involved when Sarah was just 6 days old. She oversaw the hearings from 2013 through until 2019, including approving Sarah living with her father and stepmother in July 2019. And Judges Nathan and Williams had more limited involvement, with Nathan handling an emergency hearing in 2014 and Williams making an interim care order in 2015. The question a lot of people are going to ask is, look, to what extent bad decisions were made? It would seem that bad decisions were made to send Sarah back to her parents and the appalling circumstances, the appalling abuse that she received. Why shouldn't the judges be held responsible?
Well, so I should have corrected you. I think it's Sarah,
Sarah,
so you know,
okay, but I wasn't sure. Some people say Sarah, some people Sarah.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure it doesn't, given what...
Well, no, it matters a lot. Sarah is probably right.
And the facts of the abuse that she suffered is unbearable for any decent person to even hear, and let alone understand that poor little girl. Why shouldn't they be liable? Well, the other thing to flag is just that when we talk about anonymity, that's also why we still wear wigs. So if they see pictures of these judges, they're wearing wigs, and it does make it practically hard to find. If I put my wig on properly, and then I take, I'm, well, you won't know who I am, and that is what wigs are for.
Oh no, absolutely, it's all about anonymity, isn't it? It's respect for the court. It's anonymity and it's tradition.
Yes, and then making people feel uncomfortable is a good way of getting them to tell the truth as well. That's another theory. So the RC, the Royal Courts of Justice, deliberately makes you feel uncomfortable the minute you walk in. That's what it's doing. But why shouldn't they face accountability? Well, I think that rather they should. You know, I think at the very least we should know why these decisions were made. It's going to be very difficult if that's now, as in I hope that there were reasons given at the time, and we can have published those reasons given at the time, so that we can better understand them. I think we also need to realise that the court would not have been acting alone. So no judge did this. No judge would ever do this without reports from social workers, without reports from experts. So let's get them all in. I think under the original hearing, they were given anonymity too, and I'm not entirely sure that's true. If we're charitable to Mr. Justice Williams, we'd say, given the Southport, what happened in Southport and stuff, maybe everybody was a bit overcautious at that time, provided there is no, and I really don't, there mustn't be any violence or irrational response to this. And I'm actually sure that there won't be, because I think most of us will just be sad. But provided there isn't any risk of that, and I think there really isn't, let's find out more, let's know more. And if certain ideas have taken place where in the public sector certain things are prioritised over other things, could we please return to the priority being the safety of little girls and little children?
Yeah,
you know,
that's got to be right. But we talked about last time the difference in one of our wonderful episodes, the difference between criminal liability and civil liability. And judges are obviously, just to be clear, they don't get immunity if there's anything criminal. If they accept bribes or things like that, the immunity doesn't apply to that. But people who have a responsibility, the social workers, who the judge is reliant obviously on some of their reports and so on and so forth, which is part of the reason you can't blame the judges. They have to depend on the evidence given to them when reaching these decisions. What is their liability? We talk about a duty of care, and the tort of breach of that duty of care. To what extent could those social workers and others involved in Sarah's case be liable?
Well, I think they are. So I think they owe a duty of care. The question and the trouble with civil liability generally is that you need somebody with the pockets to fund the litigation, and you need the concept of serious compensation. I mean, who would get compensation? Sarah's estate? I mean, who...
That's the usual thing, isn't it? The estate would step into her shoes. It doesn't bring her back. And the whole idea of tort is to put them in the position that they would have been if the tort hadn't been done. And what
well,
price
it's even
in
worse,
life? And, you know, it's a strange concept when you look, and we talked about this last time, you know, the value of a finger or two fingers or an arm. It's the law tries to be quite scientific and clinical about it.
It's even worse. I wonder, she won't have had a will. So are her parents her...
And this is the awful thing, isn't it? Under intestacy rules, that's what it would be. SIP, first of all, spouse issue parents. Well, that's where it goes. It'd be absolutely appalling on that basis.
Yes, it would. So it's beyond. So the I'm afraid, and this is a good example of the limits of law. You know, the civil. I'm afraid my entire world, my entire court system can offer nothing realistically. But I think we should have knowledge of what happened. I think it would be good. I mean, we're not going to learn lessons if we don't know what
Yeah,
happened.
and I think we've got to, in a way, avoid. I've never really liked the lessons will be learnt routine because you're sort of working on that sort of basis, unless actually lessons are learnt. So clearly, questions need to be asked. I always say sunlight is the best disinfectant. We need to see what happened. What was the information given to the judges? That's what would have helped. Now that the family courts are going to be a bit more transparent, what is that information? Where were the failings? Because this Sara was failed by the system somewhere. And what we need to do at the very least is ensure that that doesn't happen again. So just looking at that, though, that the social workers, just to be clear, the judges have impunity. They've been named now and so on and so forth. Unless there's criminality and so on and so forth, judges have that impunity and so that they can make their decisions freely. That's the whole idea. Those who have an obligation to look after the social workers and so on and so forth, they don't have that immunity, do they?
No, and they don't. And we need to find out, or somebody needs to find out. I mean, it doesn't necessarily always need to be public, but somebody needs to find out. Somebody needs to inquire because we don't want this to happen again. And if the state is failing consistently, we need to find out why and how we fix it. Because just the simple priority, Andrew, is that we must return to protecting children.
Yeah,
That's it.
absolutely. We need to make sure that the wrong decision, basically to send her back to her parents, that was one of the worst examples, rather than putting her into care again and so on and so forth. That was clearly based on some report. And the judges, I say, people always blame the judges because they made the order, but they would have had evidence from the social workers and various others because that's how the family courts work, isn't it? They're not working in a vacuum. They would have got reports and recommendations. And they probably would have thought, well, safety of the child first. But this, based on the reports that they were given, that's how the judge made their decisions.
Yes, and I think people need to bear this in mind when they talk about safeguarding and assisted suicide or assisted dying, because the idea that a High Court judge is going to cover all the High Court judge will get is a bunch of reports that conclude this person needs to die. And the High Court judge is not Judge John Deed. He's not going to sit there, he or she's not going to sit there able to overturn those reports. If there's nothing before the judge,
Yeah.
that has to be accepted. I love that it goes back to that truth of, Mr. Justice Goose, when he said, the prosecution have told me this is not terrorism, and I have to accept that.
Yes.
He does. That's procedurally what he absolutely must do.
Yeah.
And therefore, their judges are just not this eternal guardian. They're not Jedi. Okay?
Yeah.
They're not. So, this awful case needs, if we're going to stop it happening again, we do actually need to find out what went wrong.
Yeah, and I think that's right. So, should, and the final question then, there has been clearly a failing. We've got to work out where that failing is. I would suggest it's not the judges at fault, but rather the system that presented the evidence to the judges, because they would base it on that. Those reports clearly were defective because Sarah was let down horrendously by the system. Should the system, should those who made that mistake be punished?
Yes, I mean that's basic, isn't it? Otherwise, how are you ever going to get a good system? And there's another concept that we need to pull out of this, particularly in the notion of family law, because it's become very fashionable to want to know what the child thinks. Well, one of the most heartbreaking thing about Sarah's case is that Sarah often blamed herself and still wanted her dad to love her.
Yeah, awful,
That.
awful testimony. I've seen that she felt it was her fault. So, and there was notes saying, I'm sorry for being a bad girl, I'll try to be a good girl. Words to that effect was awful.
Yeah, and so just can we just get it through our thick skulls that we can't just ask the children and then do what children say because they're children, And that I it do we do need to be adults, and I worry that that's gone out of fashion,
Yeah, no,
and I
you're
worry
absolutely right.
that.
And just finally, then, judges, when they say, look, judges being accountable, we talked about they've got basically their immunities, they can't be sued as such. Having the appeal, having being at the public scrutiny is quite damning in itself. But judges can also be reprimanded and being taken off the bench. Just very briefly, tell us what those circumstances are.
Nobody really knows now. We now have the Office of Judicial Conduct, which is groping its way through our brave new world. When Tony, in the old days, the Lord Chancellor did it. And that was a much better system and it worked better. When Tony Blair got rid of the Lord Chancellor, literally the surviving judges were like, Am I? Is it? Is it? is it me? Is it you? At the moment, the master of the rolls, who was the one who overturned anonymity in this case, has taken a large and practical role simply because he seems to enjoy it. And it depends whether the other office, just to explain, is the Lord Chief Justice. In theory, the president of the Supreme Court could stick their oar in and say, look, I want to talk about this. But so it's all a bit confused. I would go back to a Lord Chancellor, and that is the best way to discipline and control judges. The actual best way to discipline and control judges is fear of embarrassment, because fear of embarrassment is much more terrifying for barristers and judges than anything else. It really is. It motivates them beyond anything. And that's great. We know what motivates them. We'll design a system to get good outcomes.
Yeah, and I think that's got to be right. So I think people need to, in summary, that they've got this immunity, and that's got to be right on that sort of basis, unless there's criminality involved, in which case that will happen. If there are procedural stuff and it's not in their judicial purpose, I think you could look into it if it's costing money in court. But the general sort of proposition is they're dependent on the evidence put between them, and the failings happened in the social services and so on and so forth, rather than in the courts. That would seem to be a fair summary. Okay,
Good.
Stephen, another horrible case. We will come back and unpack more here. You can find me at Andrew Eborn at Octopus TV. Do subscribe on YouTube and Substack now. I'm Substack as well. Stephen's also on Substack and doing brilliantly well. So get lots of join that happy band of merry men and women and follow him on that sort of stuff. But for now, Stephen, thank you very much for joining me.
Bye-bye.